Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins, and it's great to have your company.
To walk the last 20 kilometres into Santiago from anywhere on a pilgrim route on your own was just incredible. And in fact, I didn't meet a single pilgrim till I got into the square.
That voice you just heard is Paul Murray. We'll get to Paul and his remarkable story in a moment, but first, this is a podcast about the Camino de Santiago. Almost 250 interviews with pilgrims from around the world who have walked or are walking El Camino, a series of pilgrimages across Europe. Pilgrims walk the Camino under the blessing of Christ's apostle St. James the Stronger. The most popular route is what's called the French Way, which winds through the countryside from St. Jean-Pied-de-Port on the French side of the Pyrenees, across the Alps into Spain, and then right across to almost the west coast, to Santiago de Compostela. The city's name translates to St. James under a field of stars. And we're told the bones of the disciple are interred in a silver casket beneath the cathedral. No one can really say for sure if it's St. James, but ask most pilgrims who have walked beneath the field of stars, and they'll tell you they most definitely felt blessed. They talk of small miracles. They talk of friendships formed that will last a lifetime. They talk of meeting people who needed help and they were happy to help. They talk of taking home those small miracles to their own communities. They talk of overcoming obstacles they never imagined they could overcome. And in most cases, the concept of pilgrimage and the lesson learned on the Camino become a sort of life map. It guides you to a method of thinking that lends itself to a gentler path. Perhaps you don't need all the bells and whistles. Perhaps you don't need to be quite so frightened or quite so worried. Or perhaps you can relax a bit knowing you've encountered a pretty good version of you. What a blessing. Overcoming obstacles to lead your best life. Northern Ireland will feature throughout this week's episode, so when I went in search of a quote, I thought first of the Nobel Literature Laureate, Seamus Heaney, and in my search, I found a couple of worlds colliding. He said, "If you have the words, there's always a chance that you'll find the way." My guest this week is Paul Murray. Paul's releasing a book called From the Gaeltacht, I think I've got it right, to Galicia, Gaeltacht to Galicia, A Son's Tale. Paul's on the line. Welcome, pilgrim.
Gracias, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Now, how was my my Gaelic there? Gaeltacht?
I regret to say the pronunciation is Angaeltacht, and these are Irish-speaking communities in the west of Ireland.
Yeah, that's right. So I did a bit of homework, and it's these regions where they still speak the Irish language. And why is the Irish language so important to the Irish? Why these Gaeltacht, why these regions maintain their traditional language? Why is it so important?
I think it's a case of donning their national identity, Dan. We go to Wales quite often because my wife and I live here in Gloucester in England. And it's just amazing the number of people that speak Welsh. In Scotland, there's not an awful lot of Gaelic spoken. In Ireland, it's Irish is certainly on the increase in the last few years. And people, it's the first language in many secondary schools. And it's a way of bringing a nation together and proud of our heritage.
It's such a beautiful language. It's I've heard it sung, and when it's sung, it's beautiful.
It is, and it's a very poetic language as well.
Yeah,
I did Irish. It's 50 years since I studied Irish at school in Belfast, and since the website my brother set up last year, the belfastdoctor.info, that sort of really publicized my father's story.
Yeah.
Carl is my brother. And Dad used Irish in his diaries to get round a censor. And I know we'll come to that shortly, but it was picked up by the Irish media. And it's sort of the interest that has been shown in Ireland has kind of led me to reacquaint myself with Irish. And I'm doing it through Duolingo, which I'm really enjoying. It's terrific. So I've got the incentive to learn it. I'm a linguist. I'm a retired modern languages teacher, but I always found Irish really difficult at school. And I'm enjoying it tremendously now. It's reacquainting myself with the language, and a lot of it is actually coming back.
The book is part history lesson, partly an exploration of your spiritual pilgrimage, but it's also a love story, a story about your parents, Eileen and Frank. And this book, when I read it, it's a son's blessing in many ways. So why don't you tell us about your parents?
Oh, Mum and Dad, thank you for that lovely compliment, Dan. I never thought of it as a blessing. Mum and Dad met, they were both Belfast school pupils in segregated schools, as they would have been in those days, and still are to a certain extent. I listened yesterday to your interview with Maria Seco, and she was talking about living in Ireland. This is a Spanish lady from Pontevedra, living in Ireland for 15 years, and how it was a bit of a shock for schools to be segregated. And it, to a certain extent, still is nowadays. But back in 1929, when they met in an Irish-speaking community, the Gaeltacht, in Ranafast, in Donegal, they would have gone to sort of lessons in the kind of the local school during the day. So Mum would have come from one secondary school in Belfast, and she was from Kilkeel, which is about 30 miles to the south of Belfast. And the students would have got together in the evening at a ceilidh, at a local dance. And Dad describes the event when all the women, all the girls rather, were sitting along one side and the boys would arrive, and he picked her out and danced with them, and that's how it all began.
Wonderful. It's so beautiful. The story of the book is so gorgeous. But you write in one section there, I highlighted with my highlighter as I do, our paternal grandfather Charles bought a shop at 155 Old Park Road, Belfast, in 1896, along with his brother Daniel, and they made it into a spirits grocer's. What's a spirits grocer's?
Oh, a spirit grocer's. Because they sold alcohol, basically.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. Spirits grocer.
There's nothing of anything spiritual, I can assure you.
I thought, wow, I've stumbled onto something here. It's a good name for a song, right. Spirits Grocer.
There you go.
In another section you write, our grandmother came from Clones in County Monaghan. Educated partly in Dublin, she learned as a teacher to play the violin and was an avid reader, mainly of the classics, a love which she passed on to Dad and his seven siblings. When it came to emptying our family home in Newcastle in 2007, we were amazed at just how many books our grandmother had amassed. But during the period of the Great Depression in the 1930s, she carried food and blankets to the poor of the area, often to the detriment of her own family, as those were the words used by your dad. Tell us about the poor in Ireland, this image the rest of the world has from films like Angela's Ashes, which is Ireland, not Northern Ireland, but I think the father in that movie was from Northern Ireland. Tell us this abject poverty, how much is it woven into the narrative of the Irish?
Yes, I mean, you could kind of associate it probably, Dan, with Ireland being basically a rural community, especially in those days. But of course, we were living in, Mum and Dad were living in Belfast, different parts of the city.
Yeah.
I suppose my vivid impressions growing up would, because Dad was a doctor in a working class area of Belfast. He had patients from both sides of the religious divide, and they hadn't much money. The patients that he cared for. Mm-hmm. And originally, I think the National Health Service, which extended obviously to Northern Ireland as part of the UK, I think it was set up in 1946 or 1948. But before that, when Dad got back from the Far East and being a prisoner of war, he would have patients would have brought would have come to his surgery and would have just given him what they could afford, basically. And if they couldn't afford half a crown or whatever it cost for a consultation, and obviously for the medicine, they would have dispensed as well. He said, no, just forget about it, you know. And obviously everything changed once the National Health Service came in. But there was abject poverty in those areas. And to a certain extent, when the trouble started around about 1969, it was still a situation with incredibly high rates of unemployment, which were just kind of rife in both Catholic and Protestant communities for civil unrest.
Yeah, I want to get to that. That's the most fascinating aspect of the book. But you also talk about your dad's time in India, and you mentioned earlier that he was in the war. He finds himself in Changi prison in World War II, alongside a lot of Australians, I might add, and ends up in prison on the Japanese island of Hokkaido. Did he talk much about it, Paul, when he came home? Like, do you remember him talking about it much when he was when you were a kid?
No, Dan. Only when we went to Donegal on holiday. We'd go for the month of July every year. A bit like the Spanish, you know, because they take a month's holiday, don't they, rather than the sort of 2 weeks that people tend to take in this country. I don't know about Australia. Mm. So he'd be in a really relaxed frame of mind. So the seven of us, my four siblings and mum and dad, we'd all pack into the Austin Cambridge car and drive the sort of 5 hours that it took in those days to get to Donegal and the west of Ireland. And we would really ask him to tell us stories about the prison camp. And I suppose in our kind of formative years, basically, Dan, all we wanted to know was, did you ever kill anybody?
Yeah.
No, he didn't. It really was, I've got to pay tribute to my brother Carl again, because by transcribing Dad's secret diary that he kept every day for 42 months, apart from 1 month when he was in hospital, the whole story and the things that happened to him have really resounded with us. And to be able to look at some of the incidents and then to start reading other accounts of what other POWs have written about really brought the story to life. But now they were encouraged, virtually told, when they got back to Civvy Street, do not talk about your experiences, not because they're censored, but because it will bring up lots of nightmares of the things that you went through. So the best way to cope with it in those days was keep stum, don't talk about it.
Yeah. I wonder, your dad, you've mentioned he's a GP and a GP in Belfast, and I want to talk about that. It's a terrific story, to be honest. He's a medical officer in Hokkaido, and when I think of images of those times, Changi, it's desperate. It's disgusting. It's horrific. Did he ever give you any explanation about how he survived? Because so many didn't.
That would certainly, although he wouldn't have gone into specific stories when we were younger, we knew and mum knew as well that the two things that got him through were his Catholic faith and his love for our mum.
Yeah.
And he mentions, and you read this in other accounts as well, Dan, that POWs have written and about the fact that the younger POWs, they when they found things really difficult, they would sort of, they'd have given up the ghost because they didn't have the support perhaps of a girlfriend, or the correspondence wasn't getting through, and they just felt so far from home. And Dad knew that that Mum loved him, and they, I mean, it's so innocent, because they never even kissed, and they sort of got engaged by telegram, by letter rather, and sort of this was in before Singapore fell to the Japanese. So yes, that was a really difficult thing for the younger men. Yeah. But his Catholic faith was, yeah, it's the twin pillar of those two things that got him through. He's always said that. I'm talking about him as if he's still alive, but he died back in 1993. But writing the book has really allowed me to engage with him in a really significant level.
Yeah, well, it's a terrific story. And the way you write it, it's as if we kind of get to know him in a way, which is really a tribute that you've been able to pay to him, which is lovely. How does somebody continue to believe in God when they're overseeing such horror in a prison camp, that your father would have seen such horror? How could he continue to believe in a God that is happy to oversee that kind of hardship, that kind of horror?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, you know. It when you get events like 9/11 at school at St. Peter's High School in Gloucester. I mean, I've been retired as head of modern languages 10 years now, but I remember we used to have I think it still goes on, a mass on a lunchtime once a week just for the staff. Mm. So in a little chapel in school, I remember one of the head of RE coming in and just introducing the mass and just saying a few words about 9/11 and saying how much it really shakes your faith that an act as horrific as this could actually take place. So in adversity, the men somehow found the strength to get through. And in fact, one of Dad's many roles in the camp as the commanding officer, because he was a major, was a lay chaplain man.
13 prisoners of war died on your father's watch. How did he live with that? And did he talk much about that?
No, he didn't. And that's the really interesting thing about the diary, because there's a daily entry. He diluted the horrors that they went through, because you remember the diary wasn't basically for wider consumption. It was a diary written to Mum. So he spared her the horrors of what was happening in the camp. So the few occasions when he actually did describe in slightly more graphic detail what actually happened to some of the men, one in particular, Private Raymond Suttle, it really strikes you that he was so angry at what had happened. Mm. And of course, the other thing was, the big thing was, we should have asked Dad this. How come the letters were, the diaries were never discovered by the Japanese? How did you hide them? So there would have been a fear that if they had discovered the letters, that there would be retribution taken on the prisoners.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Tell us about catching flies for cigarettes.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, that's the story that most resonates. There's a guy called Gregory Michener, I think, who wrote about the Hell Ships. He's an American author. And so it's described in there. But the original story comes from a prisoner from Kent called Keith Mitchell. And Dad doesn't recount the story in the original diary. But in the bowels of the prison ship, so the prisoner spent 3 weeks traveling from Singapore to Moji in the southern Japan, to divert them from the cramped and appalling conditions on the boat and the exercise, they were only allowed up about half an hour a day. He got them to catch flies. And obviously the bonus from that was not just keeping them occupied and active and the men falling over each other to try and catch the flies, but basically to reduce the possibility of a disease. And so they would have had to catch 10 flies and bring them to him. And he was in charge of the cigarette allowance. So he for each 10 flies, they would have been given a part of a cigarette. And there were, in the hold, were just, I mean, all my siblings are just so proud of the story. And to say that there were no casualties in the hold of that particular prison ship called the Wales Maru.
You and I can't imagine it, can we?
No, no.
We simply can't. It's the most extraordinary thing. And you talk there about much of what you write about from that time comes from the diary and some letters that your father wrote home to your mother. What was it like when you sat down to write the book, to relive those messages?
Very special. Carl did my brother, he did a 1980s version of the letters based on Dad's thoughts. What would that have been, 50 years later? Dad wrote a version having met Keith Mitchell in England. So he would have put his... of course, it wasn't the original thoughts, but things that had come to him since and more criticism of the Japanese in the letters. So before I started writing the book, which I began a couple of years ago and managed to finish in 2 years, thanks to COVID, because I got plenty of time on my hands, it was just lovely to be able to dip into a date like 23rd of October, which is today, and seen on the 23rd of October, 1942, what was he doing, or moving forward to 1943. So to have that at your elbow was always good, but absolutely essential in writing the book. Mm. And then, of course, with names being mentioned, especially the 13 that died on Dad's watch, and being a member of the researching FIPO history group, which and co-FIPO, Children of the Far East Prisoners of War, then you've got access to other documents. So I had those at my elbow to be able to dip into and flesh out some of the details. And I mean, you're constantly finding out new things. And I know with the book being published that there will be more people that will get in touch. And hopefully one of my big aims is to get people to go to Japan, because people will go to Singapore and visit it, but people that you find that are extremely tolerant, you know, that have had a father or a grandfather or an uncle who's been a prisoner of war, and you say, oh, yeah, you've been to Singapore, that's great. Have you been to Japan? Oh, no, I wouldn't go there. And some of the older men and the researchers in Japan that I met, I asked them, with the help of my interpreter, have many families sort of come over to follow in the footsteps? And they said, well, we've had hundreds of Koreans that have come, but... if you add together the number of British or Dutch or American families that come, that's probably about 5. And you're thinking, well, this is just incredible. I know it's an expensive country to go to, and it is a great distance away, but I was staggered to hear that so few wanted to come. Perhaps some on principle that, no, I'm not going to go to that country.
Yeah. Despite everything your father went through, you write in the book, he rarely, if only briefly, complains of feeling unwell, but a frostbitten right thumbnail he gets on Thursday, the 8th of February, 1945, is the only one physical manifestation that as children we all remember. Tell us that story.
It's just something as a young boy or a young member of a family, you'd just be aware of that sort of physical manifestation of the thumb. And what really brings that home, Dan, is the incredibly high humid temperatures in Singapore. And then they were in, you know, the most basic clothing as they headed off to Japan. Hokkaido, as you probably know and your listeners, it's the northernmost island on Japan, and it's got freezing winter temperatures. And you're thinking, you know, you see these documentaries about people climbing Everest and stuff, and I myself and my wife Jamie just love the mountains, and when you see the hand being frostbitten or their face or whatever, and the blood circulation is gone, you think, and then you read the diaries and the extremely cold temperatures in the winter. And when I visited in October and November 2017, it was getting decidedly chillier, certainly. The other thing, the physical manifestation that would have stared all of us in the face, particularly when we left Belfast, we were forced to leave at the height of the troubles, really, and Dad took early retirement in 1975, but he was presented in September 1945 with an enormous scroll of tributes by the 350 British and five American POWs in the final prison camp that he was in. So this... rather than a kind of a separate room in our large house in Belfast, the bungalow in Newcastle, where Mum and Dad moved to, this huge scroll of tribute, it sat on the wall behind the TV.
Yeah.
So you could see it all the time, and it's a most moving tribute, and it moves you to tears every time you read it, basically.
Yeah.
So that's been a real... journey in discovering the background to it and who the calligrapher was and who the composer of it was. And Carl's done some brilliant research into that as well.
Yeah. There's a beautiful picture in the book, Paul, of your mother and father, Eileen and Frank, on Newcastle Beach, as you say, in County Down. They look blissfully happy. And you have to admire someone who could have lived through what he did, actually both of them, really, and still come out smiling. And you mentioned there that you had gone to Hokkaido and you walked in his footsteps in many ways, Paul. Retracing your father's war journey, what did you learn on that pilgrimage yourself?
I'd start on the Singapore leg of the two-country visit to the Far East. And my sister Valana joined me. She lives in Canada. And we walked the 14 miles from... We reenacted Dad's walk into captivity, which was 6 days after Singapore fell. We walked from the Padang and St. Andrew's Anglican Cathedral in the centre of Singapore, which was used as a hospital and an operating theatre before the Japanese invaded. So we did the 14 miles or 22 kilometre walk as a pilgrimage to Changi, and that 22 kilometers is the average walking distance that I would have done as a pilgrim on the various caminos that I've done in Spain. So that was symbolic in itself. But really, the thing that the Camino does, it teases out your vulnerability, basically, and because of the arthritic condition that I've got that I inherited from Dad, it meant that I was able to do 11 miles but had to give up for the last three. Mm. And Valana carried on with the son of a prisoner of war from a very famous person, David Marshall. So his son, Jonathan, accompanied us on the walk, but they carried on to Changi, and I took a taxi for the last 3 miles. And then welcomed him when we got to Changi. So that was very special to reenact the walk and using Dad's diary and again Keith Mitchell, some of the landmarks along the way that they would have seen. And then Valana, because it was quite a demanding schedule that I got for Hokkaido. She felt that she wasn't able to accompany me there. So I was going to be in something like five hotels in a week or slightly longer. So that was incredibly important. I got the most tremendous welcome in Japan from everybody that I met. It made me feel very, very vulnerable as well, because I visit Spain very often because I volunteer to run the Refugio Gaufelmo. And being fluent in Spanish and relating to the locals in Rabanal, you suddenly go to a country where you have zero language and you so much is relying on gestures. Yes, I had an interpreter and a guide, but my goodness, what are these people saying to me? And the older people that were talking about what happened and the Japanese version of what they saw as the prisoners of war, because the Japanese suffered a lot in that area in Hokkaido and all over the country. You should get the other side of the story, but they weren't that patient in allowing my translator to give me what they were saying in English. But I did find out a tremendous amount about what was going on. You know, there are two sides to every story, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's so true. And let's talk about two sides to a story. You write in the book, our dad's family came predominantly from the townland of Cullion near Draperstown in County Derry, and he spent every summer there with his brothers and sisters when they were packed off, armed with cricket bats and tennis rackets and footballs. But on a more sinister note, four of his uncles used to take to the hills in the vicinity each night in the early 20s to escape raids by the Black and Tans, the ill-disciplined British military force recruited into the Royal Irish Constabulary. They were drawn from the ranks of the soldiers who had survived the Great War and were infamous for their reprisal attacks on civilians. So let's talk about faith and religion and politics and nationalism. The combination of all of them has fueled conflict in Northern Ireland for generations. What was it like being brought up in the Troubles?
Oh, well, I've got a chapter on the Troubles in the book, Dan. It's segregated schools are still very much the norm in Northern Ireland. It is beginning to change, and integrated colleges and schools at certainly at secondary level are beginning to appear. So it was really weird, Dan, being going to a Christian Brothers Grammar School in Belfast for 7 years and never having any Protestant classmates, nobody from the other side. And then you go to Queen's University, which I did to do my 5-year modern languages degree. And because I was doing Spanish as well as French, the majority of students that would come would again be from Catholic secondary schools, because Protestant secondary schools tended to study German. So there was just a handful of schools. I can remember a student from Grosvenor High School in Belfast doing Spanish as part of his degree, and he was a Protestant. And you sort of thought, this is the first time I've got to meet Protestants, let alone relate on a personal level. Mm-hmm. So it is the way forward, and these kind of barriers are of segregated schools, and you know, as far as I was concerned, the Protestants could have had horns growing out of their heads because I never met them. You never went into a Presbyterian or a Church of Ireland church. You just didn't do that, you know. The kind of vocabulary that people used was that he or she has turned, implying or saying that they would have changed their faith, you know. So, oh no, don't go into one of those churches. And it's just ridiculous, you know.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that your father was a GP in Belfast at that time. There's a terrific website. You mentioned that your brother set it up, the belfastdoctor.info. There was even talk of a documentary about your father and the work that he did. Did he treat people from both sides of the conflict?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can tell, you probably know this anyway, people in Ireland, especially Northern Ireland, can spot from a name a lot of the time, whether someone is a Protestant or a Catholic. So they were equally so from both communities. Mm. One of the advantages of a name like mine is that you can't tell what foot I kick with, basically. So that's nice in itself. So in the old days, I'm talking about sort of being a teenager.
Yeah.
People would trying to work out whether you were one or the other, basically. Then they would say, what school did you go to? Just happened to drop it in the conversation. And I would have done the same. But, of course, living in a much more tolerant society, which is what England has shown me, that things like that just don't matter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They don't matter. We talked about the love story in the book, the love between your mother and father, and you write about their pilgrimages to, I hope I pronounce this right, is it Loch Derg? Is that right?
It is, indeed.
Okay.
Yes.
Talk us through those journeys, your mother and father's pilgrimages to Loch Derg.
Yeah, they did. It's staggering, actually. They did 11 in all, but not together. And they did promise each other in the letters that they would go together. But Velana, my sister that I was telling you about in Singapore, she came along within a couple of years of them getting married. And then there were, I've got two other sisters and then a younger brother. So there was just not time to go. So it was it was very special for them to go. And people still make the pilgrimage. It's very arduous. I sort of say in the book that I would much prefer walking 1,000 kilometres from Sevilla to Santiago de Compostela than spend a weekend barefoot on an island in the centre of a lake in County Donegal, County Fermanagh in Ireland.
But wait a minute, before you go on then, what is this pilgrimage to Loch Derg? Why are you barefoot in the middle of an island? What's going on there?
Well, yeah, and you have, I think the only thing you have on the first night there over it's a Friday to Sunday basically, is water, and I don't think you get your first meal until the Saturday evening. So it's traditionally, it's St. Patrick's oratory in a church on this tiny island, and for centuries pilgrims have made a pilgrimage out to the island. I mean, it's the same idea if you're doing a walking pilgrimage in Spain or whatever, you're going to get blisters, you're going to get tendonitis. So the suffering is a little bit a part of it.
Okay, so that's the Loch Derg. The Camino de Santiago has been a huge presence in your life. In the introduction to the book, you say, I linked my interest in long-distance walking pilgrimages in Spain and, to a lesser extent, my parents' multiple pilgrimages to Loch Derg with Dad's imprisonment in terms of not only their respective physical challenges, but also the desire to subsequently change how we treat our fellow human beings. In recounting some of my experiences on three pilgrim routes, I've grown increasingly aware of the value of prayer. Now, this is where we combine your father's story, your father and mother's story, and your story, because I want you to tell us about the value of prayer.
When I set out to do my first pilgrimage, which was a Camino Francés in 1998, so Dad had died in 1993, The idea I took a little bit about suffering there, just to experience in an infinitesimal way just a little bit of what he went through, just to identify with him and to reflect. The byproduct really was those quieter moments, you know, because especially when you walk on your own. I did walk with a companion from just across the road here in Gloucester, Keith, and we were together for 3 weeks. But when we were forced to split up when I had tendonitis problems, it became a much more spiritual pilgrimage and a much more religious one. And I would renew, I suppose, my my faith, my belief in God grew a heck of a lot more. Mm. I mean, people talk about, people that don't know about the pilgrimage, apart from the fact that they think, well, how on earth can you walk so many weeks? But I think a lot of people sort of look at you, especially in England, and think you're some sort of religious crackpot, you know, and it's just not like that. So particularly, as you know, I've always done my pilgrimages in sort of high summer. And particularly that last hour of the day, Dan, normally you try to get off the route by the time the midday sun comes along. So that last hour or so, when it's much more difficult, you would start to pray, I found, for it's kind of a byproduct of what I didn't expect to find on the Camino. You'd pray for friends and family that were ill. And then on another day, you'd pray for family and close relatives that had died. And then really curiously, you'd think, well, what about them? What about family, like grandparents that you never ever met, or stories from the past? And these people deserve your prayers as well. You've got all the names. Thanks to Carl, he's great at looking at genealogical family trees. So those names were sort of there, kind of thing. And so it's kind of a duty to do that as well.
Who do you hope is listening to those prayers?
God, Jesus Christ. It's just so much a part, especially when you're on your own and being reflective. I remember walking into Santiago. It's the last pilgrimage I did was in 2014. I couldn't do the 1,000 kilometers in one go from Seville. So I did it in two goes, one in the first half as far as Salamanca, and then the second half 2 years later in 2014. And as I got closer to Santiago, it was Easter time. Quite a number of Spanish pilgrims, who you probably know, some of them will do just a week on the Camino because they're committed to the work jobs and stuff like that. So it got to around about Good Friday, I think it was, and suddenly all these pilgrims joined from Spain, and they had to get to Santiago by Easter Sunday because, unlike in probably Australia and in this country, people go back to work in Spain on Easter Monday. It's not a holiday. So I suddenly found myself, because I had some leg problems towards the end, I suddenly found myself totally on my own walking into Santiago on Easter Monday. So to walk the last 20 kilometres into Santiago from anywhere on a pilgrim route on your own was just incredible. And in fact, I didn't meet a single pilgrim until I got into the square.
How fantastic. Oh, my gosh, that's just so wonderful. Tell us about Donegal in Northwest Ireland. You mentioned it earlier, your family would go there. But its links with Spain, you write about it in the book. Tell us how that story resonates with you.
Donegal, I have to correct your pronunciation where the stress can
Donegal.
Donegal, well done. Great stuff. There's the teacher in me. It's a bit like talking to you, just doing pronunciation and stress, Dan, a bit like talking to your students and saying, if I start saying something like, what planet are you on, rather than what planet are you on, it totally changes the sort of the meaning, and people sort of look at you. So Donegal's, we never wanted to go abroad when we were younger. Obviously package holidays sort of, I mean, I'm 67 now, package holidays didn't exist really when we were teenagers. But I mean, even when they started to come in, we didn't want to go anywhere else. Donegal's always been a very special place for us, and that's where my book launch will be on the 6th of November in the village where mum and dad met. And but the link with Spain and the Spanish Armada, a lot of the majority, in fact, of the vessels after the defeat of the Armada in the English Channel, they returned to Spain, going up the North Sea, round the north coast of Scotland, and down the west coast of Ireland. And the second in command of the Spanish Armada suffered two shipwrecks, and eventually in the third one, He didn't survive and was drowned with 1,000 other sailors on the treasure ship, the Girona, off the North Antrim coast. But getting back to Donegal, his second shipwreck was on the Santa Ana at a little village called Rossbeg, which means the small peninsula in Irish. I used to think it was a small rose, but it's not. It's a small peninsula. And he survived that shipwreck. His name was Don Alonso Martinez de Leyva. And the reason I chose to put him in the book, apart from the kind of folklore in the area and the stories that the locals would talk about the Armada, was that there was an Irish sailor that sailed with him originally called James Macquarie. And he wrote an account, transcribed by scribe, I suppose, and the characteristics of de Leyva were very similar to my dad, in that the nobility, the sons of the nobility of Spain, all wanted to sail with de Leyva, and their admiration for him was total. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that although the link might seem a little bit obscure, my fascination with Spain and looking at some of the documentation that I came across in the National Archives in Simancas, near Valladolid in the centre of Spain, which is also on the Camino de Madrid, I think it's called, mm-hmm. on another Camino. It's been fascinating piecing together some of the history of that second shipwreck on the Santa Ana.
You've done so much work. It's a brilliant read, that aspect of the history. Not only the war, your father, the troubles, Spanish Armada, and its relationship with Ireland and your upbringing and your history. But you also write about Rabanel del Camino. Tell mm-hmm. us about your relationship with this little town that most people stay at the day before they get to the Cruz de Ferro.
Yeah, it's a village rather than a town. So they've got 40 inhabitants all year round, and the numbers swell in the summer when sort of the younger families would return to mm-hmm. be with their parents or relatives or whatever. So that they would, most of them would in fact live in Madrid. So the numbers would swell, and of course the numbers would triple in the summer with pilgrims arriving. I have to correct you and say that it's really sad now, Dan, because a lot of the pilgrim guides for that particular stage of the Camino, they recommend you start in Astorga and you go up to Fontebadón at the top of the mountain,
yeah.
close to the Ferro, and that's so that you can be there for the sunrise at 6 o'clock or whatever time it is. So a lot of pilgrims are bypassing Rabanal,
right.
and it is a very special place. I mean, I know you've been there a couple of times, haven't you?
Yeah, I love it. Love it.
But they'll have a coffee at 11 o'clock. You know, they'll mm-hmm. get up at 7 or 8, so they'll be there in 3 hours. And oh, let's carry on up to the cross for this flipping sunrise, and. The little church across the square from Gauthelmo, from our
yeah.
hostel, it's one of, I mean, it's such a small village, but it's got three churches in it, and the most humble of the three is Santa Maria, and that's where Compline and Vespers are sung, and the monks come across. There's three monks there permanently, so they come across from the church. And at tea time at 5 o'clock in the huge idyllic garden that we've got at Gauthelmo, they'll come across and they'll say, Paul or Jenny Heesh from Australia.
Yeah, my friend Jenny, yeah.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. 2018, I did a stint as an hospitalero with her and Gilbert Cabergs from Belgium. We were a great team. But anyway, so the monks would come across and say, are there any readers that you'd like to read at Vespers? It's a Víspera in Spanish. And so we would approach people. Normally the Spanish, so they'd like a Spanish reader normally, and a German one, an English one, and a French one. That's normally what it is. So we would sort of say, yes, and then we'd ask someone, would you like to read? And a lot of the Spanish would say, it's a bit sad in a way, oh, can you get somebody else? I'm católico no practicante. as in a non-practicing Catholic. And we'd sort of say, well okay. But I mean, we've had agnostics, I'd say we, I mean, it's not us, but it is a special part of the pilgrimage to yeah. have a service that's very much geared towards pilgrims. So we'd say, well, it doesn't matter one faith or none. You're perfectly welcome to read, and it's such a privilege they talk about that afterwards to read or whatever. But it's a marvelous village, and Maria Seco talked the other week about having the language, and it's wonderful to be able to communicate with the villagers. I mean, I stayed there in 1998 on my first Camino, and I got there down at 12 o'clock, and there was a great big queue of pilgrims outside the front door, and I thought, I'm not going to get a bed. This is the one place in 800 kilometres that I want to stay in. And then the hospitaleros on duty said, is there anybody that's on their own? Because we've just got this one spare bed. And I said, yes, please. And they signed me in, and that was special to be there. So
wonderful.
I started to volunteer as an hospitalero. My headmaster at St. Peter's was happy for me to go because I get to practice my Spanish. And so even though it was sort of the last week in term and not too much happening at school, he allowed me to go. So
wonderful.
I volunteered 5 times as an hospitalero there.
Tell us about walking the Camino with the choir.
In 2019, just a small group of the choir that I sing with, the choirs, the big choir, there's about 100 of us, and we're based in Worcester and Gloucester. But a small group of us, I got together, there were 10 of us, and I think 3 camp followers, for want of a better word, who came along. And we rented a couple of people carriers and flew into Madrid from Bristol. And we drove to Rabanal. We stayed overnight in the Maison, which is just the other side of the square from Garcelmo, with Cristina and Antonio and their family. And we rehearsed as a dry run for 3 concerts that we were going to give in 3 churches. By the way, we never got crowds like that, or we never really get crowds like that in England. In Spain, it was just incredible. The churches were packed, and we went down really well with locals. Great. So we rehearsed in the salon, in the lounge, the Pilgrim Lounge and hostel. And then we gave a little impromptu concert. It was just a dry run in the open air in the garden at Gauthelmo. And then we set off walking the next morning with... So we would take it in turns, the drivers of the 2 vehicles, to drive while the rest would walk. Because I've walked up to the cross many, many times when on duty in Rabanal, I obviously did the driving for the first day. And they'd all brought their stones, the symbolic weight, to leave at the foot of the cross. And so they were waiting for me before they did the next part down to El Acebo, which is halfway down the mountain towards Ponferrada.
Yeah.
And we were giving a concert that night, so we had to rehearse. It was a tight schedule, I tell you. We had to rehearse in the Basilica in the afternoon, and then we gave a concert after the evening mass that night.
Why did you decide to take the choir on the Camino? What was the motivation behind that?
Well, we talked about the full choir going and just singing in churches, but not walking. And it was really important. When that idea fell through, it wasn't related to COVID or anything like that. It was just a non-starter and too difficult to organise. I just thought it would be a wonderful idea to have a smaller group, to put the onus on them to do the bookings, the hotel bookings. I just gave them the email address. It was just so easy to do. Gave them the sort of itinerary, got in touch with clerics in the churches there, and it worked out beautifully. And a number of them have said that this has just changed our lives, you know. And it was really, really emotional to do the final concert in El Cebreiro. As you know, as you cross into Galicia, that's the first community that you meet after you leave Castilla León.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful, and to have lots of pilgrims there, because the second concert was in Lugo, which is on the Camino del Norte, but it's obviously not as many pilgrims do that route. So the church was full, and it was, I mean, what a setting, really, yeah. That they couldn't believe. We'd walked up to it the previous day, so they got to have a look in Santa Maria again, the same name as the church in Rabanal, but a wonderful setting and just stunning views across the landscape.
Fantastic. You also write in the book, and I just want you to talk about it briefly, you want to raise awareness of the painful arthritic condition of axial spondyloarthritis, which you inherited from your father. You mentioned it earlier. Tell us about that journey.
Well, all money, if I make any money from the book, is going to an organisation, a charity based in London called NASS, NASS, .co.uk, and they do tremendous work for sufferers of that arthritic condition. It affects all the joints. Lower back is the worst, but it can be around the shoulders. You can even have trouble with your jaw, actually, if you open it too much, but it is lower back pain, which makes singing in concerts and standing for a long time really, really difficult, especially now. Mm. So dad got really stooped. I'm not as stooped as him, but in later years, and it wasn't diagnosed until the 1980s for him. And the really helpful thing, Dan, is they NASS produce videos, exercise videos, mm-hmm. And because there is no cure for axial spondyloarthritis, and by the way, congratulations, because you pronounced that absolutely perfectly. But exercise is the key, even when you're getting a flare. I used to think it was called a flare-up, but they call them flares now, like trousers. So when you're getting a flare, even at a really reduced level, you need to be able to just try and keep the exercises going. And the good thing about the website, I finally got to the point after going all around the houses, is that they, yes, it's in English, but they do videos of the exercises. So the gardener that we employ at Rabanal to cut the grass in the orchard, Goyo, his name is, I found out a couple of years ago, he suffers from it. And I'm not sure the treatment he gets is what I would have recommended or medical experts here would. But howsoever, the exercises, you don't need to be able to understand English. So Goyo can look at them. Anybody from any corner of the globe can look at them. And I just thought, this is just perfect. So when I checked with my siblings, are they happy for any money I make to go to NASS? They said, oh, yes, absolutely, you know.
Fantastic. Oh, well, congratulations. We've talked about war. We've talked about world war. We've talked about war on the streets of Northern Ireland. We've talked about love. We've talked about pilgrimage, Spain, spirit, faith, and hope. And you say in the book, it's your hope that any reader with a particular interest in any of these themes will perhaps discover aspects of some of the others that may relate to their own life's journey. And that's a wonderful gift that you've given to us all, Paul. And I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for your endeavours, and thank you for telling us these wonderful stories. Congratulations on the book. I'll tell everybody where to buy it in the outro. Good luck for the launch on November the 6th. And thank you, Paul. And blessings to you and your family from me and my audience, my small little Camino community.
Thank you so much, Dan.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm just looking at the time and it's over an hour now. So take the collective love and support from all of us in your endeavours. Buen Camino.
Thank you. Can I just say one other thing quickly?
Yeah.
When I say a little bugbear of mine, but if you wish a pilgrim buen camino, and especially when you're walking back at the end of an hospitalero stint and you're walking back eastwards instead of westwards and you're meeting all these pilgrims coming towards you, You know, when company knows the greeting, so that some of them will laugh and point. Now, Santiago's that way. What are you doing? But anyway, so it's buen camino the whole way. And if you don't want to be taken as a foreigner, if instead of saying buen camino back to them and they've greeted you first, and you say igualmente, which means equally or the same to you, I'll get you, go on, say it, igualmente.
Igualmente.
Perfecto. And that's really nice. So you can, even from buen camino, you can tell it is somebody Spanish or the English or perhaps some nationality, but I sort of pride myself on that. But saying igualmente is just a lovely way of saying same to you rather than buen camino, buen camino. Thank you again, Dan. That's just been amazing. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, Paul. All the best.
God bless. Bye.
My guest this week is Paul Murray. The book is launched in County Donegal on November the 6th. If you'd like to attend, the invitation is at thebelfastdoctor.info, thebelfastdoctor.info. You can pick up a copy of Paul's book From the Gaeltacht to Galicia, A Son's Tale, at thegreatbritishbookshop.co.uk, thegreatbritishbookshop.co.uk. The Northern Irish poet and Nobel Literature laureate Seamus Heaney said, "If you have the words, there's always a chance that you'll find the way." We've certainly learned that this week via Paul Murray and his remarkable story. Thanks for your company as always. And again, a very special hello if you're listening on the Camino right now. Why not reach out to someone at your accommodation tonight or the albergue or in the bar or restaurant, wherever you're having dinner, and invite them to become a My Camino the Podcast listener. We're always looking to grow our little community. I appreciate the support. Until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino.